In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Please be seated. Today we have what I think the lectionary shapers intended, but was not planned by me, as a series of continuing difficult passages. Today is perhaps the most shocking in its language, to start a gospel reading with a command to hate your own family. I want you to feel how shocking that actually is. Right, it should disturb you. We have, after all, commandments to honor our father and mother, commandments to love your spouse, commandments to cherish and honor and disciple your children. So to get this language from Jesus that is so deliberately shocking should provoke a reaction in you. And I want to take just a moment to ask you to think about your first initial gut reaction. When Jesus says this thing that is so shocking, so challenging, do you start by saying, well, that's ridiculous, he can't mean that, I'm not going to listen? Or do you start by saying, that sounds so difficult, so challenging, God, I don't know how I'm going to be able to do what you've asked there. Do you feel a sense of sadness as you think, wow, does God really want me to reject my family? God, that's a lot that you're asking, but it's you asking. And so I'll follow you. Or do you think, well, I'm not going to do that. If that's really what he's asking, then I'm out. I'm asking for your gut reaction because it says something about sort of where we stand initially as we respond to God and his call towards discipleship. And the Christian journey, the Christian life, is one of continuing growth, growth in love, growth in faithfulness. Right? And so if you start in your first reaction with a reaction that's maybe a more negative reaction, a reaction that says, God, I don't want to listen to you as you tell me this, that's okay. It's okay in the sense that you are called to continue growing, called to increase in faith. But it's important to know where you are on that journey, to notice your first reactions. If your first reaction is to say, Jesus, what you're asking of me is too hard, does that, again, provoke a response of, help me, God, in my weakness, or it's too much to ask God, ask something else? Does it provoke a pushback from you, or does it provoke a plea for help? And if it doesn't provoke a plea for help, then maybe asking God to give you a heart to ask God for help, if I can say it that way, right? Remember the prayer, God, I want to believe, help me in my unbelief, right? A similar prayer there. Now, what is it that Jesus is actually saying here? Notice that this passage begins with a multitude is following Jesus. That is, Jesus is very popular. There's a big crowd that's following him around to see what he's going to say. And what Luke keeps pointing out is there's a difference between the large crowd that is interested in Jesus and the people who are actually following Jesus as his disciples. In our modern day, we might say things like, there's a large group of people who are willing to sort of watch Jesus on TV and see what he has to say about important issues and tune in once a week to listen to him or watch him. Very different, very smaller is the group who actually wants to follow him and be his disciples. And I want to make very clear the distinction here is between the multitudes who are interested in Jesus but have no relationship with him versus the disciples who follow Jesus. And the reason I want to point that out is there's not a third category of people who are Christians but are not disciples. It's not a category. There's no category of people who have a relationship with Jesus, they're just not interested in doing what he says. Not a category. The two options here are the people who are interested in finding out more about him, but are not yet ready to commit to him, and the people who have actually made a commitment to him to follow him. And you could add in a third category that aren't talked about in this passage, but the people who've already decided to reject him, the people who've decided to hate him. That's the third category, right? So in this passage, it's about making a decision. Are you going to eventually give up on him and walk away? or are you going to be one of the people who follow him? If you're in that multitudes category, if you're in that category of a big crowd who's learning about Jesus to decide if you want to make a commitment or not, are you going to say yes or are you going to say no? And what Jesus is doing is he's using shocking, stunning language to say, this is the cost of saying yes. It is everything. When he says, hate your family, he's deliberately using hyperbole, right? A poetic technique in which you use strong, striking language to emphasize what you're saying. Children do this quite a bit. It's not, I don't like the Brussels sprouts, it's, I hate Brussels sprouts. It's not, I would prefer something other than cauliflower, it's, cauliflower is the worst, right? There's actually lots of things that are worse than cauliflower. You could be eating dirt, you could be eating worms, but no, cauliflower is the worst, right? That's one of the poetic techniques he's using. The other one is he's using actually an idiom. So an idiom is something in a language that insiders in the language understand. It's a figure of speech, but it's very difficult when you're learning another language to pick up the idioms because they don't translate directly. The idiom in this Jewish context in the Hebrew and the Greek as they're adopting stuff from the Hebrew language is love and hate as a way of defining a choice between two things, two mutually exclusive things. The big example in the Old Testament is, I love Jacob, I hate Esau. Right? Said by God himself, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated, was language for God to say, I have chosen one of them, I've rejected the other one. And that's the language that Jesus is adopting here. Right? Love God, reject this other call, even your family. So again, it's strong language, it's shocking language. What's the point of it? Let me start with a story on that. So when I was in seminary, I was part of the kind of the student government for the seminary. It was sort of the, you know, the student body thing that you would see in high schools and colleges, but it was for the seminary. So we had a team of 10 of us. We were paid with a scholarship to be working on these different committees and things. And one young woman who was on my team, I was overseeing, had been someone who was very responsible, very successful in her life before coming to seminary. She was very much from one of these kind of overachieving families, right, where everyone's driven and they know what they're going to do from the time that they're very young and they're working very hard. And she'd gone off and she'd earned a law degree at a young age, been very successful, had a career as a lawyer, and at some point felt that she was called to leave her legal practice and go to seminary to become a missionary and a Bible teacher. So here's someone who's been very responsible her entire life, very hardworking, and she shifts from the law to working in the seminary, or to going to seminary, to be a missionary and a Bible teacher. And she starts missing committee meetings. And again, it's part of your payment as a scholarship to go to these committee meetings. So they're important. It's like she's missing work. And then on top of that, I find out she's missing classes as well. Someone who's been very responsible up until now, and she's missing really important things. And I found out what was happening is she would be getting ready to go to class or getting ready to come to committee meetings, and she'd get a call from her dad. And her dad would say things like, well, your mom is busy right now, and I need somebody to make my lunch. Come over, please. And she came from a cultural background. It happened to be Korean, but there's other cultures that have similar expectations, and the Middle Eastern culture, at least particularly in the time period in which the Bible is set, is similar, in which as the firstborn daughter, she was expected to be the one who cared for her aging parents. She was supposed to actually not have a career of her own, and instead stay home and be the one who cared for her parents into their old age. And at this point, her parents were not so elderly. It's not the situation in which they were in their 90s and needed somebody to come by to care for them in sort of a nurse capacity. Right? They were retired, but not that elderly. It was just an expectation. I need somebody to make my lunch. Come over right now. I need somebody to do the laundry. Come over right now. And the interesting thing in her family was that she was let out of those expectations when she was a lawyer. The idea was, the cultural expectation was, you're going to come over and you're going to be the one who cares for your parents. But if you're willing to be a doctor or a lawyer, that's so prestigious. That's such a kind of a feather in the cap of the family that will bless that and you get excused. You don't have to do the first daughter role if you're going to be a lawyer. We get to tell all of our friends our daughter's a lawyer and very successful. It's worth it. We'll let you out of that. But even though they were a Christian family, even though the dad was a Christian, as soon as she shifted over from being a lawyer to being in seminary, that changed. All of a sudden, he was back to calling her up and asking her to come over, and asking her to come over at times that actually got in the way of her preparing for the ministry. And eventually she even realized that he seemed to be deliberately doing it on days that would prevent her from going to classes, or that would prevent her from studying for her midterms, or prevent her from doing the things she needed to do to graduate from seminary. And she realized that what her dad was doing was communicating to her, look, I will let you out of my expectations for you as my firstborn daughter if you're going to do something prestigious. But if you're just going to serve God, if you're just going to be in the ministry, if you're just going to be a missionary and a Bible teacher, well, then you're back to serving your family. And as they talked about it and it created this tension, I don't know that they had this conversation exactly, but I can imagine a conversation in which she said to him, Dad, God has called me to be a missionary. God has called me to be a Bible teacher. I have to say no to you. I want to help out still. If you need me to make your lunch the night before, I'll come over on Monday night and make your lunch. But I can't stop going to class on Tuesday morning to come over right away and make your lunch. I can't do it, Dad. I can't do it. God has called me to go to seminary so that I can go be a missionary. And not only do I need to say no to you now, but in a few years, I need to leave and go to another country, and I'm not going to be able to come over at all to make your lunch. I'm not going to be able to be the daughter who cares for you in your old age. I can't do it, Dad. That's not what God's called me to. And I can imagine her father responding, why do you hate your father? Why are you ungrateful? I can imagine him responding that way in a knowingly manipulative way. I'm saying something very hurtful to you right now. Or I can imagine him genuinely thinking, wow, you call yourself a Christian, but you're so hateful to your dad. A good daughter would be over here caring for me right now. Why are you so hateful? And I can imagine the dad actually believing that, right? This is not a sermon about exact expectations from fathers and towards daughters and all of that, because it might also be a faithful way to serve God to be the person who stays home and cares for your family, to be the person who puts some of your own desires for your life on hold in order to care for an aging parent. That is a good and legitimate way to serve God. It's not the way that she believed that God was calling her to serve God. That's my only point with this story in terms of that calling. But she believed God was calling her to be in seminary so that she could be a missionary, and her dad was giving a rival claim to what her life should be about. And she was forced into a position to say, do I say yes to God or do I say yes to my dad? Which one do I choose? And in that case, for her to say yes to God felt to her father as if it was hatred, felt to her father as if he was being rejected. Not that he was being rejected. She was still a loving and faithful daughter, but it felt like rejection to her father. Think about other examples. It doesn't just mention parents in this passage. It mentions spouses. It mentions children. Think about spouses. Maybe you were not a Christian when you got married, and you married a person who was not a Christian as well. And then you became a Christian, and now your lives are different in a lot of ways. Or maybe you were a Christian when you got married, but you have continued to grow and become more passionate and committed in your faith, and your spouse hasn't. Or maybe you knowingly married a non-Christian and you realize later, okay, that creates some tension in our relationship. That creates some rivalry in terms of values. It creates a tension because God is calling me to one thing and this spouse of mine is not being called to the same thing. And it works out in very practical ways. Are you going to go to church every Sunday? You already went to church on Sunday. Do you need to go to this other thing? Do you need to do this other thing for church? Don't talk to me about this Bible stuff. Don't talk to me about this Christian stuff. You might even have some competition in terms of talking to your kids about your values. Or with children, as you think about what to leave them or not leave them in your will, as you think about what to spend or not spend on them, maybe you've been very successful financially. And so your kids think, oh, I should just get all that. And you think, is that actually the best thing for them? Is that the most faithful thing to give them a big pot of money? Or should I think about other ways to spend that money? Ways to, sure, help my kids, but not just to hand them a pile of money. And they might say to you, you hate me. You hate me. If you loved me, you would just give me all of this. And you say, no, that's not the best thing for you. That's not the best thing for you. You think of other family tensions, expectations your family. Every family, every single family develops and grows with a set of expectations of what's normal. And the most Christian family in the world still has a mess of non-Christian stuff in their family. And then you just go down the spectrum from there. There are plenty of Christian families who have really unhealthy, even toxic stuff in the way that they relate to each other, in the values they have as a family, which means that every single one of us, even as we seek to honor our father and mother, our brothers and sisters, our spouses, our children, every single one of us should be constantly looking at, how can I continue to grow as a Christian? How can I let go of the stuff from my family background that is messing me up, that is keeping me from being a mature and faithful Christian? And you don't have to do that by saying to your parents, to your brothers and sisters, to your children, to your spouse, you're terrible and I'm rejecting you. You don't say that. And yet, even as you say to them, I love you, I honor you, but I cannot do what we've been doing as a family anymore. This is what I have to do as a faithful Christian. I have to set these boundaries. I have to change what we've been doing. As a family, we've been doing things that are unhealthy, that are not right. I'm still going to love you. I'm still going to have a relationship with you, but here's the boundary. Here's what I'm saying no to. Families, spouses, children will often react with anger, with being upset, with being hurt. Consciously or unconsciously, they'll be manipulative. Many of you have experienced this before, right? How dare you treat me that way? If you loved me, you would do this. Clearly, you hate me. Whether they say it in their words or not, right? Whether they say it directly or not, you are choosing something other than the family. And what Jesus says at the beginning of these verses is, yes, you are choosing something other than the family. You are choosing God. And you cannot have a rival for God. The call to Christian discipleship is a call to put Jesus Christ above everything else. Everything else. So much so that it might cause people you love to feel as if you hate them. Jesus is not saying you should actually literally hate your family or your spouse or anyone else. It means you should so choose Jesus Christ that it might actually cause people to feel as if you hate them. That's their own stuff. That's their own unhealthiness. That's their own misunderstanding. That's their own junk. That's their own sin. But, nevertheless, you have to hold on and move forward in loving and choosing Jesus Christ. There cannot be a rival for God's love. There cannot be anything that's on the same level as God. And to put anyone on the same level as God, to put anyone as a rival to God, not only fails to love God, it ultimately fails to love that person. There's a beautiful, sad but beautiful, poetic description of this in Milton's Paradise Lost. This is the great classic epic poem about the fall, about Adam and Eve in the garden and Satan tempts them and all that. The devil has tempted Eve and she's already given in to sin, so she's become a sinner, she's fallen. And then she meets up with Adam, and Adam realizes that she's fallen, and he so loves Eve that he decides that he will also give in to sin because he doesn't want his wife to be alone. He doesn't want her to be separated from God alone. So he makes a decision, and it's cast in very romantic terms. to choose sin and to choose to fall for her sake so she won't be alone. And the moment he does that, he immediately becomes a sexist jerk. It was cast in very poetic language. I will sacrifice myself for her. And as soon as he becomes a sinner as well, he's no longer able to love her. Not well. As long as you love God more than your family, you'll be able to love your family well. As soon as you choose to love your family more than God, you actually become less able to love your family, not more. As soon as you say, I'm going to put my spouse before God, you actually become someone who is going to have a harder time loving your spouse. You're going to have a harder time loving your family. Think about it this way. If you have a spouse who doesn't ever want to go to church and you say, okay, well, I'm going to compromise and I won't go to church either because I'm going to value our marriage so much that I'm going to stop going to church so that I can be with my spouse instead of church. What happens is you lose the influence of church in your life. And church is not a stamp card kind of thing, right? It's not go to church 4 times in a month and you get your stamps on your card and then you get credit for that. Church is where you gather together to learn about God, to worship together, to have community together, to support and bless each other. It actually has an influence on your life. And you can miss church once in a while without a huge effect in your life. But if you're consistently missing church, your values actually start to change and your life starts to change and you're less able to be a loving spouse. What Paul suggests, and when I say suggest, I really mean commands, but it's a command that he doesn't make out of the blue. He explains why it's such a good command. He says, if you are the spouse of an unbelieving spouse, if you're the wife of an unbelieving husband or husband of an unbelieving wife, you should pray diligently for the conversion of your spouse. Pray daily for the conversion of your spouse. Love your spouse so well that they are drawn to the Christian influence in your life. But as you do that, continue being a part of the Christian community. Continue loving and worshiping in the Christian community. Do not compromise and say, well, I will live like a non-Christian because my spouse is a non-Christian. If you are a parent and your child is involved in bad and sinful things, yes, you want to love them into the kingdom of God, but you don't do that by tolerating or by enabling their sin, right? Similarly, you don't get engaged in bad or sinful things with your parents. And you could just go down the list of all the different applications of that. Sometimes people believe that the loving thing to do with someone who is acting against God is just to give in to them on whatever they're doing. And they think that's being more loving. But it ends up having a worse effect on them, not a better one. Being calm and steady and continuing to love God even more than those that you also love actually is the most loving thing you can do for your family member. Loving God is your best chance of loving well anyone else. Loving God, being faithful. So let's look briefly at the rest of the passage because it falls right from there. You're on a building project. Who in the world would build a tower not counting the cost first? Right. For most of us, maybe a better sort of contemporary analogy would be, I was about to say it's a better analogy. Let me back this up. Plenty of people do this. So who in the world is not a good preface for this? And yet, who that is wise would take out a mortgage you can't pay? Right? You buy a house knowing you can't afford it and just saying, well, maybe I'll get a raise. Maybe I'll get a better job. I can afford the down payment in the first few months and probably something will change in my life that'll allow me to afford the rest later. Bad, foolish. Again, I'd like to use the phrase, who in the world would do that? But the answer is, you know, whatever it is, 10% of people in the U.S. or whatever the number was in our housing crisis a while back. Bad decision. Unwise decision. You've got to count the cost. You've got to make sure you can afford your mortgage before you take out a mortgage. You've got to make sure you can afford your car payment before you buy a car. And you've got to make sure that if your business is going to build a new building, that you can actually afford to build that building. Because you don't want to build half the building, get stuck, you can't finish it, and now you can't pay the cost. And similarly, he says, who in the world would go to war with another country, and then only as you are in the war and you can't get out of it anymore, say, oh, well, they have a much larger army than us. Oops. Right? Bad decision. Lives are on the line. Don't do that. Don't do that. That's crazy. And one of the added pieces to that image of war is it's in the context of choosing for or against God. So it's not just who in the world, when life is on the line, would make your decision without actually counting the cost of your decision. But now it's, are you going to oppose God? God has the infinitely large army. Don't go to war with God. Count your forces. You've got you. He's got the whole universe. Don't go to war with God. Bad idea. And don't build your life on a series of values and decisions such that you're going to come to the end of your life and say, I didn't even half build that tower I wanted. I was going to live a life in which I created for myself this beautiful life that was going to make me happy. And I didn't even think about eternity. And even in this life, I didn't accomplish all the stuff that was going to make me happy and fulfilled and fix everything for me. I'm 70 and I feel like I haven't accomplished the stuff that I wanted to when I was 50. Why did I wait until now to start asking questions about what life was all about? Or 30, or 20, or 10, whatever age you're at. You count the cost of your life and you count the cost of your decisions. And what Jesus says is, count the cost of discipleship and realize, one, that it will cost you everything, and two, that that's a bargain. Discipleship costs you everything, and it's a bargain. Number one, if discipleship costs you everything and all you got for it was eternity with God, that's a bargain. If discipleship meant a lifetime on this earth of misery and pain and not getting any happiness in this life, and yet you got forever in the presence of God, with all the fulfillment and blessing that receipt you received forever, that would still be a bargain. And it turns out that's not even the deal. Because it turns out that when you give everything to God, that's actually the best and most fulfilling life you can have. It turns out that when you decide, I choose God over my very family, you end up typically with a better family than you would if you chose your family first. And if you say, I'm going to give up my possessions to God, not meaning writing a check to the church for everything you have in the bank. That's not what that means, at least typically. We might have a building fund coming up at some point, so I might revise. No, I'm just kidding. It's not true. I wouldn't do that. No. But if God says, I own everything you have, it turns out what that means is that everything you have belongs to God and is dedicated to Him. And people who see their possessions that way end up doing things like not going into debt because they bought silly things that will make them happy for a week and won't have any lasting influence on their life. People who see everything they have as stewardship of what belongs to God actually end up making better financial decisions, having more discipline, deciding to be content with less because God tells us to be content and not to seek our joy and our fulfillment in physical things. And then you end up having money left over at the end of the month, and you end up having money in savings, and you're able to give something to the church but still have some money in savings. And 40 years from now, you discover you're much better off financially because you gave everything to God than you would have been if you were living for yourself and saying, I'm going to enjoy every penny I've got and raise up, you know, big credit card bills and things, buying stupid stuff that I think might make me happy and know even as I'm buying it, it really won't. Giving everything to God ends up making you happier. But you don't do it with this expectation, God is going to make me happy therefore I'm going to enter a bargain with him. God, I'll give you stuff as long as I get more out of it than I give. You don't do that. You give everything to God, and it turns out that's the very best life you could live here on earth as well as in heaven. It's a shocking bargain, but you can't do a shortcut. You can't decide, first I'm going to enjoy everything. You know, first I'm going to decide I should get the most out of this. And as long as I do, I'm willing to give myself to God. You start by saying, everything belongs to you, God, because you don't know the path that you're going to have towards blessing, if I can put it that way. You don't know that you won't go through major family difficulties as your life has changed. You don't know that your spouse or your parents or your children might not say to you, I am so angry and upset at these changes in your life. You are messing everything up. We had a happy family. It was working, which usually means we had a happy family in that we were all used to being unhappy together in a particular way. And now you are messing everything up. Psychologists talk about this all the time. As you grow healthier, everybody else gets upset with you at first until they get used to you being healthier and they start making changes. Right? Just like if you break a bone and then you don't get it fixed, your body gets used to having a poorly formed bone, and sometimes the doctor has to re-break the bone to fix it, and you go through a lot of painful adjustment before everything works out right. Families are the same way, relationships are the same way. As you make healthy changes, as you make godly changes, it creates more short-term difficulties that eventually lead to blessing. But it can be painful and sacrificial as we start out. In all of this, the call is to choose God above everything else. To choose God even above your family, even above your own life, even above everything you have. That is the calling of discipleship for every single Christian. It's not an optional. It's not the super Christians. It's not if you want to be in ministry. It's not if you want to be the extra pious. The basic calling to every single Christian is follow me, take up your cross, and follow me. That is, give up everything you have to follow me. And the surprise is, as you give everything up, you get more than you ever thought you could. But in a sense, you have to play the psychological game of letting that be a surprise. Because you don't know what God's going to give you as you give everything to him. You don't know how it's going to work out exactly. You simply have to decide that if you want to follow God, you give everything to him. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.